This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
On Friday, February 1st, another young black body littered the Oakland sidewalk between 20th and 21st Street like a crumpled newspaper. Gunshot wounds painting the concrete a bloody canvas. Life leaking from a frame too young to know anything about life. By the morning, he will be gone. A sidewalk cleaner than usual, a blank spot marking his absence like graffiti scraped from the wall. This is for the youth murdered this year that will not be remembered, whose names we do not recite on television screens across the country, whose killers we do not warn our children about, whose deaths inspire no legislation, no gun control. The 143 victims of gun violence in Oakland last year, the ones we washed from our memory before the stains even dried.
Hey, how y'all doing? All right. You know, we work over there at the California Youth Outreach with the Measure Y team. We out here helping, you know, the little young individual. We heard the little young guy got shot. Was it right around this area?
Yeah, because this church right here, they just gave me a bullet point. So we'll just go here and we'll go around there.
Okay. Thank you, guys. All right. Appreciate you.
A young 15-year-old, a young individual got shot on 65th or 66th Avenue. It wasn't no specific block. So we was riding around looking for the individual, looking for what happened. We couldn't find out what was going on.
How you doing?
Hi, I'm Chaplain Miller.
I'm Ron Weissen, California Youth Outreach. We come and look at the family with the little youngster that just got shot, the little 13-year-old here, so we can speak with the family or something like that. Then we let them know.
Okay, so when there's a shooting, you guys come around?
Yeah, when it's a shooting, a homicide.
Well, God bless you and the work that you're doing.
We teach life skills, job development, job readiness. We provide case management. So we do all the nuts and bolts type things to help these young people develop the skills and develop the confidence so that they can go out and do different things.
Most of us guys been on probation, parole, been in the institute. So now we're trying to help the young individuals that we can relate to.
We come from the hood, we come from the street, so that's how we got all our wisdom and knowledge on what's going on. We've been there, we've done that.
Hey, Ryan, if he calls you and asks for me, I'm going to let him use my airbrush gun so he can start trying to learn how to do that. So.
They probably not listening, but they're going to listen later. At least they know they got a way out. When they get their back against the wall and they want to change their life or something, they pick up that card and give us a phone call.
Ron is successful for many reasons. He's had his own challenges in his own life. He's had his own losses.
When I was a young youth, I was just getting into mischievous things for no reason, running away, stealing, and I just was being bad because I thought that was a cool thing to do.
I grew up out here in Oakland all my life. Mom raised us. Father wasn't too much around. We basically raised ourselves in the system. So I've been in the jail system in and out all my life since the age of probably 13 or 14 years old. My son, he died, passed away in 2005. He was going to my grandmother's house. He was in the passenger seat. My nephew was driving, and they went down the wrong little neighborhood, and these guys was out there drinking and shooting their weapons. And one bullet went through the back window, shot him in the head and killed him. So I said, shoot, God must be testing me or something.
And after something happens to you in your life, you lose somebody close to you to the streets in Oakland, and you get a little wake-up call.
It's on me. You have some people with the train of thought that we need more cops on the street to offset the violence. Then you have other train of thought that says, you know, we need more social programs and more social services. But it can't be all or nothing. The social programs are able to directly connect with the community, whereas law enforcement is not there to do that.
You didn't get the other piece of the bun? Appreciate it, bro.
Yeah.
Thanks.
We do a barbecue to attract the people in the neighborhoods and those certain kind of neighborhoods when they're hanging out and selling and doing whatever they're doing. We'll just go out there with our barbecue bill and set up shop and everybody come get food and we'll sit around and we'll talk. You know, it's called a slow dance. We'll talk, eat food, break bread. We try to give them a way to get the meet and greet different people that's in their community.
What y'all got going on the grill?
You want a burger?
So what is this for?
We barbecue on the hotspot, and basically we say guns down, man.
Before, there were some rules to the game. Old people were off limits, children were off limits, women were off limits. Crime really started to elevate with the introduction of crack to the communities. You would start to see neighborhoods that were at one time fairly safe become havens for criminal activity.
We killing each other, but they look just like us. I mean, you know, brown killing brown, black killing black, for no apparent reason.
How that back coming along? What's up with you, man? Ryan.
The work that we do goes into the neighborhoods that have been hit the hardest by homicides and violence, robberies, and we target those particular areas.
So we from the streets of Oakland, all of our team, we grew up just like you guys. We want to keep this message in your helmet. Get your money up, but put the guns down.
We had an event out on 65th in the village, just had a lot of shootings in that area. We was there just speaking to them, letting them know ain't good, where they're going, where they're leading, the road that they're going down, they really don't want to be there.
Who in here know at least one person that they friend has been killed in the violence of Oakland? Put your hand up. Who in here know at least two friends that's been killed in the violence? Keep your hand up if it's two. Three. Four.
These young people don't want to be out there shooting. They don't want to be hungry. They don't want to be unemployed. They don't want to live the life they live, but that's the only life that they know. So when they have someone that could show them a different way, or that actually takes some interest in their lives and their personal lives and their well-being, a lot of these guys are very interested.
Right now, we need y'all to pick up the ball and carry it to the next line, to the next goal, to the next basket. Y'all can't do that, man, if y'all in somebody's juvenile hall. Y'all can't do that if y'all in somebody's Highland Hospital or San Quentin. Y'all can't do that. We need y'all here, man.
Hey, how you doing?
A young guy, he was in a vehicle going to the church, and then somebody went by, must have been a mistaken identity, shot him, and so we went over there to find out his background.
Did you find out about anything with the little situation? It was just an accident, innocent bystander, something like that?
It's not really our responsibility. It's a passion that we have to bring back to the community. We have some that might slip through our fingers, but we still touched them in some kind of ways and made them try to get their life on track.
Cool. Have you ever worked before?
Yeah, I used to work at Safeway.
But you ready to work? You ready to get on ball? You ready to do something? Okay.
We just hoping it'd be a better day, but crime and murders is going to constantly happen. If we was here working or not, we just hoping to minimize it, to cut it down some. It's not like we miracle, like we God. We can stop everything, but we can sure try to help stop a few.
Take care. We'll see you.
All right. That's the problem. All right.
Help. To your kindness, man. Right. You know, I help them out, whatever they need. It's good.
Stay out of trouble. You know, stay busy. You know, can't get in trouble while you're working.
All right, okay.
All right. All right. Take care.
She told me she left her war wrapped in the camouflage of a ruined desert, but that she is still learning to unbraid the hair trigger from her hair, to unfasten the armor from her arms, to ease the soldier's marching stress across her shoulders. It is difficult, she tells me, to come home, to unlearn your body warrior when it has been forged under fire, and in war, you are under constant fire. But she tells me she is learning to write herself free. How to build a new body of work, in pen stroke, in choreography, until camouflage is a palette she paints from, until she can dance like fire, until she can march herself home.
It's 10 minutes past daybreak, I already need a smoke break, or else I'll have a mental break and break somebody's face. I just found out that my friend's been blown away. I'm not having a good day.
There are certain
realities that you just sort of learn to deal with when you're deployed. And one of them is that, you know, you could be exploded anytime, especially in Iraq, where you were constantly hearing about mortars landing, like, on the gym or in the dining facility parking lot or right next to our smoking area on one occasion. When I realized that it was going to be my job to make that war look really good, I got really angry. I wasn't going to be a, you know, quote-unquote combat reporter. I was going to be, you know, the Army's spokesperson. I went out on a raid, and the unit that I was with, they didn't catch the targets that they were looking for. The story I was told to write was about how the rest of the unit managed to detain like 90 people, 90 suspected terrorists. But there was no mention of whether those people were guilty of anything. It made me feel really disgruntled and sad. I didn't want to be a liar.
Hi, Tracy.
Hello. How you doing, Vicky?
Good to see you again.
You too.
Let's see this great art.
I always wanted to be a soldier. I played all the, you know, Army games growing up and watched all the movies, and I wanted to be just like that. But the closest you could get as a girl was to go into military police.
There.
Let me just see. I don't have to put this together later because I don't like to rush this part. You have to get every little piece of... I just wanted to show them here. So see, that's how it'll look.
Oh, yeah.
I like to write nonfiction because nonfiction is capturing snapshots of a day or an hour or an experience that I experienced in the service that is individual to me yet reflects a collective experience. Coming back and reintegrating back in society after a deployment, my personal theory on that is however long you were gone, it takes twice as long to reintegrate back. So if you were gone for a year, it's going to take you 2 years to really feel balance again in your life.
It was really hard for me to relate to people when I came home because it was like, I can't believe you're worrying about this thing. Like, it's stupid, you know? It's complete, like, are you dying today? No.
Now, if no one perceives you as a veteran, no one's going to reach out to you for assistance and let you know that you have support. And so that continues to isolate them in terms of their experience. And when you feel isolated in one part of your life, you feel isolated in others.
When I learned how to play music a couple of years ago and started writing songs, that has definitely been an amazing outlet.
Any type of creative endeavor is going to help you integrate an experience. And it's when the memories are not integrated and not acknowledged for what they are that they're overpowering and they're consuming. And art and writing about it can help you process that.
It's try not to be a dick. Cover your mouth when you sneeze so others don't get sick. Stay out of the fast lane. I like to write songs that make people laugh. I like to write funny songs. And so I try to dovetail. I try to create lighthearted songs that are meaningful to me, but I also am trying not to shy away from songs that are a little bit more serious and darker.
Let's give all of our fantastic movie veteran artists a round of applause.
When Jenny comes marching home again, ho hum, ho hum, will she stand alone then? Ho hum. A care. Will you acknowledge she was there? A laurel wreath for her warrior's heart when Jenny comes marching home.
I'm going to start out with a song about being in the Army. When I was a younger girl, I thought I'd go explore. So I signed up for the Army and I went away to war. Before they shook me off, though they offered me their best advice.
Each of the other essays were each published in a different literary venue. And each is, this is just a small little piece. But each of these are photos that I did when I was in Iraq.
Give it a try and try not to be a dick. Try not to be a dick.
Looking around and seeing all these other women veterans who are not only like taking control of their lives, but taking control of their lives and making art that is reflective of their experience, it's really inspiring to me always.
You drive another hole into the mud of me, and I quake beneath your feet. I am a breathing thing. I am coughing. I am a coffin. You are the multi-billion-dollar industry digging wealth from my bones until we are both coughing things. Me in tremor and earthquake, you in cancer and asthma, shaking like possessed bodies shake. We are the oil field balanced atop a fault line in Inglewood, California. We are the sky burned black in Richmond, California. We are shovel and smoke, industry and natural disaster. The 9.2 million jobs raised from the cracked tombstone of my back. The ancient blood pouring fossil fuel thick into water, love. The California we promised to flatten into graveyard together. When you have made coffins out of every breathing thing here, what bones will you unearth from me then?
The San Antonio Valley consists of thousands of acres of farmland. It's a quiet, picturesque valley with small farms. It's the kind of place people come to when they want to get away from all the noise and chaos of city life.
Honey, can you just bring a sack for the other two, and I'll put the
what, baby?
Full ones in them.
Paula Getzelman and her husband retired here a decade ago.
Oh, you're going to do four of them. Okay, that's even better.
Okay.
They came to pursue their dream of owning a vineyard.
In 2003, we planted our vineyard. We planted it to Syrah because of the climate here in the San Antonio Valley, the fact that we have warm days and cool nights.
But 3 years ago, a fracking well began testing for oil and natural gas 10 miles from their vineyard. That was too close for comfort. She's worried fracking could pollute the well water that irrigates her vines.
Having the water supply contaminated in any way is going to spell pretty much of a disaster for all of the people that are growing grapes out here, raising cattle, raising horses, raising any kind of livestock.
Part of her fears have to do with the fact that the San Antonio Valley sits on top of the Monterey Shale, a giant underground formation that holds an enormous amount of untapped oil and natural gas. Steve Craig heads the local chapter of the Sierra Club. In 2010, when the federal government leased 2,500 acres of oil to companies for fracking, Craig and other environmentalists filed an appeal.
This has become the first legal battleground between the Bureau of Land Management on one side and the Sierra Club, the Center for Biological Diversity, and other community groups on the other side.
A California Senate report found that 15.4 billion barrels of recoverable oil are locked in the Monterey Shale. That's equivalent to 5 years' worth of U.S. foreign imports. Oil and gas industry spokesman Dave Quast, who works for the Petroleum Association of America, thinks fracking the Monterey Shale will be beneficial to California.
This is a technology that's been used 1.2 million times in this country. There's never been a proven case of water contamination. If you want to get hydrocarbons out of deep shale formations, you need to use, in a lot of cases, hydraulic fracturing.
But how exactly does the process work?
It's a well stimulation technology that basically involves pumping a pressure of fluids, 99.5% water and sand, down into the well, and then under high pressure fractures the shale, allowing the free flow of hydrocarbons into the well bore.
But the 0.5% Quast doesn't mention is the use of a secret chemical cocktail protected from disclosure by state laws.
The feds do not know, the state does not know, Dogger, which is to administer wells below the surface, don't know the composition of the chemistry. the local water boards don't know. The local water board that actually governs this reservoir doesn't know what's in that chemistry.
Environmentalists worry that the chemically mixed water could seep into and ruin California crops. But Quas says environmentalists exaggerate the dangers of fracking and discount the benefits of the technology.
By 2020, we could have in the order of magnitude of millions of new jobs, and that's a staggering number. Even if it's a small percentage of that, there's nobody that claims that increasing in California its oil production would have anything but a positive effect.
But on March 31st, a federal judge ruled in favor of the environmental groups, halting any drilling activity on the land until a comprehensive environmental review is completed. Even though a dozen bills have been introduced in Sacramento, California does not have any rules to regulate fracking.
Advances in technology have caused exponential increases in its use in California and other places in the United States. Public and scientific concerns have likewise increased exponentially, yet regulatory oversight lags behind, and there are, in fact, no regulations in California.
When we point to these areas and we say this is where the hydrocarbons are, in California, the hydrocarbons, they're about 10, 15, 20% of what's in that area.
Jason Marshall is in charge of regulating oil and gas companies in the state. At a recent public meeting, he discussed proposed regulations on fracking.
The most important thing to do when you're going to engage in hydraulic fracturing is make sure that the well is safe.
As Governor Brown said, we're one of the top energy-producing states, and we want to continue that. There's absolutely no reason why, if we are able to create jobs and develop our resources domestically, that under tight environmental regulations, that we would want to do business with regimes that have lax environmental regulations.
The people that are making the rules are not thinking about the long term. I understand that having access to energy is going to be important, but at the same time, not at the expense of agriculture.
Somewhere in California, a colony of bees collapses. Almost nobody hears how hundreds of black and yellow bodies litter the ground like the glass of a broken bottle. Like flower petals wilting in a storm, quiet, honey crystallized around their wings like sweet guillotines hanging from their backs. Across California, a single mother puts her peaches and cauliflower back into their grocery store bins. Apples, almonds, broccoli, they are all too expensive. Even though she can hear a buzzing growing from her child's belly, it rumbles like a beehive.
It's no secret that honeybees forage on flowers, live in hives, make honey, and sometimes swarm. That's when it's best to bring in the nearest beekeeper.
Okay, they're settling in the same place, maybe.
But there is a whole other world of less well-known bees. Unlike honeybees, they're native to the United States. They don't live in hives, they don't make honey, but they could change the way we garden and farm. Backyard gardener Celeste Etzhoken found herself on a quest to nurture native bees.
I had never heard of a native bee, and somehow a light bulb went off. I started realizing that a lot of the plants I had were not good habitat for native pollinators or other wildlife.
She looked for help from one of the few people who can actually identify most of the 20,000 species of bees, entomologist Robin Thorpe.
Native bees are things that have been here geologically in historic times, but honeybees have they're an old world species, and they were not known in the New World until the first colonists came here. They didn't get introduced into California until 1853, so they're really newcomers here to California.
But the newcomers are suffering. 30% of honeybees have vanished in the last decade.
It's probably kind of a perfect storm of at least three major stresses on bees: pesticides, pathogens, and malnutrition.
Experts say that bees are such a crucial link in the food chain that they're involved in producing as much as a third of all the calories we eat. Their disappearance is a powerful financial incentive for companies like Haagen-Dazs to help solve the mystery of the bee's demise. The Haagen-Dazs garden at UC Davis also gives Thorpe a bird's-eye view of the 80 species of native bees that frequent the flowers here.
I have a neat little vacuum tool that sucks up bees into a little chamber, which can be detached from the little vacuum gun and passed around to show people. The biggest thing is outreach and getting people to know a little bit more about bees.
Biologist Claire Kramen is looking for ways for farmers to help restore the health of all bees.
The honeybees are really, they're almost like a fragile link, you know, in the chain from farm to fork, if you will. So what we really need is a combination of both the honeybees and the native bees.
She points out the farms are attracting fewer bees because they increasingly grow only one crop.
It's kind of like if you were to only eat hamburgers, or if you were to only eat corn, or if you were to only eat almonds. Only eating one thing is not going to be good for you, and it's probably not good for the honeybees either.
That's a message that some farmers are taking seriously as they produce the food we eat each day. They're planting a variety of crops and plenty of native plants. Even their chickens can be part of the cycle, scratching at seeds that then grow into flowers for the bees. But bringing back the bees shouldn't rest on the shoulders of farmers alone. 10 years ago, bee expert Gordon Frankie started a research garden to teach people how to bring native bees back to urban gardens.
We are directed by what we call letting the bees talk to us. In other words, they will tell you what they like and don't like. And the colors they like are blues and purples and yellows, some whites.
Out came a number of hybrid tea roses and impatiens and petunias and various things that really provide absolutely no value to our native wildlife.
Armed with the insights she learned from the experts, Etz Hoken started a native bee garden at Lake Merritt in Oakland.
I somehow lucked out and picked 3 or 4 of the best plants, and we had a great first year. We attracted at least 20 or 30 species. Many of them are very small, less than a quarter of an inch, and you wouldn't know that they were a bee, but they're our most important pollinators.
She even developed a calendar full of facts about native bees.
It takes only 250 of females to pollinate that acre of apples, and the same task would require 20,000 honeybees.
If we listen to the experts and the bees, the tide could turn once again towards a greater balance between the bees we brought to California and the ones that were here in the first place.
Oakland, California is one of the most dangerous cities in the country. In this next story, I followed an Oakland resident whose first-hand experience with gun violence on this very corner dramatically changed her perspective of life.
For a woman, for a girl, if you have a pimple or a scar on your face, you're like, I look ugly. When I was modeling, it was like the highlight of my life. I was like 16, 17.
My daughter was a girl who always liked to dress up and look pretty. She loved dancing, singing.
This modeling group that I was a part of was like very popular in the Bay Area. My self-esteem was like all the way up because if you were part of that, you know, group, then you were like, a lot of people knew you. So imagine waking up and having a piece of your face missing. On November 20th, 2008, I was shot. And, you know, that event changed my life dramatically. I got a call from my mom, and she was like, Carrie, I'm super tired. I just got off my second job. Like, can you take care of the office tonight? And I said, yeah, I'll help you. And I hit up one of my friends. He gave me a ride.
Like they say, when you have a feeling about something, it's because something is happening. I came out of work and I was calling and calling her, but she wasn't picking up the phone, so I got concerned.
We finally stop at a red light on 98th and San Leandro. The driver is screaming, I'm shot, help, help. I, you know, reach over to try to help him, and that's when he looked at me. And, you know, the look on his face is, you know, it looked like he saw a ghost or something. He said, it's you, Carrie, it's you, they shot you. Oh, my God. Like, he couldn't even really look at me.
I touched my face, and my hand slumped into my face. And immediately I just started feeling, like, super sleepy.
When her friend told me what had just happened, I was left with no words. I kept thinking, maybe if I had not asked her to come and help me, it would not have happened. I felt guilty.
I hated being alone in the hospital, and one day I woke up and I look to my left and there's a woman, and she said that her name was Tammy Cloud, and then she worked as part of the Caught in the Crossfire program that offers services to youth who have been shot or injured.
She was kind of, you know, really taking in kind of what she looked like now and kind of trying to figure out what that meant. And, you know, for me, her being still in the hospital, you know, I felt like her focus needed to be more on just healing the actual wounds.
But Tammy, you know, she gave me really good advice and told me that you need to be thankful, you know, that you still have your mind and you can, you know, still walk and talk, and we have business to take care of. Like, you still have to graduate high school and you have a lot of things to attain, and we're going to do that.
Well, I just always seen leadership capabilities in Carrie, and she really wanted the opportunity to tell her story, and a position came open as a TNT violence educator.
Listen up, you guys, I need your attention. So we're going to talk to you guys about the cycle of violence. We're also going to show you how people learn this behavior. Like, people aren't just born out of the womb violent. It's learned behavior, okay? So
the fact that I can go into middle schools and schools from my neighborhoods, you know, and talk to these kids who sometimes other people think that they can't be reached. It's my therapy. I get to process a lot of what happened to me. It keeps me going.
She's living a more fulfilling life with her working for the agency, you know, by her being in school, definitely has, you know, brought her to another level in life. But I also know that behind the Carrie that we see, she's still in a lot of pain. I look to the side and I look to the right side, and I look closer at my scars and put my chin up and look at my scars under my chin. And it's hard not to feel like you're not pretty.
I think about the old Carrie in pictures, and sometimes I love that girl in that picture. You know, she has some pretty lips and just, like, you know, this, like, glare, that really confident. And then at the same time, although I seemed really strong on the outside, I was really broken and kind of shallow.
It's like they say, something bad happens for something good. This has showed her that life goes on, that she must go on and do the things that she has on her mind.
She'll go on to do great things. I see her pushing issues about gun violence, and she'll be, you know, a well-known name.
Before my incident, I really didn't know what direction I was going. And since this happened, I have a concrete idea of what I want to do with my life. I'm way happier now. My life is much, much better.
Over the last year, poachers have killed more than 1,000 black rhinos for their horns in South Africa, Namibia, and Zimbabwe. Many of those horns end up in the United States, often the first stop in the rhino horn black market. I traveled to Missouri and California to report on a federal investigation on trade in endangered species. Macon, Missouri is home to one of the largest exotic animal auctions in the United States. In this farming town, Lowly Brothers Livestock serves a growing market of exotic animal dealers and private zoo operators from across the nation.
It brings a lot of private breeders together, and it allows us to exchange bloodlines, get new bloodlines, without having to drive all across the country. It's all in one place.
I'm kind of leery. Mandy Slesser, who runs a private zoo in Iowa, bought two zebras, a mother and her four-week-old baby, the newest addition to her collection of exotic animals. But underneath this veneer of legitimate trade in exotic species, investigators have uncovered an elaborate network of dealers engaged in illegal trade in rhino horns. It is from this property in Macon, Missouri, that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's investigators established that 19 rhinoceros horns were sent to Island, California, in violation of the Endangered Species Act. Fueled by rising demand in Asia, where rhino horns are believed to have medicinal qualities, demand for rhino horns has hit an all-time high, leading to the killing in record numbers of rhinos in South Africa, Namibia, and Zimbabwe. In response to the increase in poaching, farmers have been resorting to extreme measures to protect their rhinos from being killed for their horns. Businesses like Lowly Brothers, which are licensed to deal in exotic species, have become central in the global trade in exotic animal products, including rhino horns.
Jim Lawley of Lawley Brothers Livestock Market in Macon and former Macon Police Chief Scott Zebarth were implicated in the sale of black rhinoceros horns in violation of the Endangered Species Act.
In 2011, undercover agents sold rhinoceros horns to Jim Lawley and Scott Zebarth, who, although he left the police force in 2002, still drives a marked police car. Dominic Lawley, Jim Lawley's brother and one of the directors of Lawley Brothers Livestock, refused to comment on the ongoing investigation.
Finally.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, sir, shut that camera off. Shut that camera off for a minute.
Recorded telephone conversations between Jim Lawley and undercover agents reveal an elaborate trail of interstate trade in rhino horns from Texas to Illinois, Iowa, Missouri, and California. Acting on information provided by undercover agents, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services obtained search warrants to inspect all outgoing mail packages from Lowley Brothers. In packages sent through USPS, UPS, and FedEx, agents found 19 rhino horns in 9 packages sent by Jim Lawley to Jimmy Carr, a California-based Vietnamese-American businessman who has pleaded guilty to dealing illegally in rhino horns. At this Vietnamese shopping mall in Westminster, south of Los Angeles, Jimmy Carr's brother, William Carr, says he will shut the business down after Jimmy Carr is sentenced.
We're going to close tomorrow. I'm just waiting for my brother, the court day, and then see what happened.
I close it. I don't want to do anymore.
Okay.
Because I'm not a businessman. But right now he's doing the business and then he went to jail. So I don't know what to do.
The business itself was convicted along with its owner, Jimmy Carr. In this store's bathroom, where stacks of USPS mailing boxes are addressed from auctions across the nation. At least three of the arrests in Operation Crush were made at airports. Here at Long Beach Airport in Southern California, Wade Steven of Hico, Texas, was arrested with $345,000 in cash. Steven is one of five people that have pleaded guilty to dealing illegally in rhinoceros horns. In its ongoing effort to crack down on illegal trade in rhino horns, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services has launched an all-out campaign codenamed Operation Crush.
This is what we've got, and what we're dealing with, black rhinos, white rhinos are the two that are coming through that we're seeing coming through the United States.
My name is Denise Larrison.
U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services is also training dogs to sniff out rhino horns and other exotic animal products in shipping containers at customs control points around the country.
17?
Yeah.
Get it.
Rhinoceros horn.
Meanwhile, in Los Angeles, five convicted rhino horn dealers, including Jimmy Carr, are awaiting sentencing. The Lawley brothers have never been charged and continue to operate their auctions.
San Francisco's iconic Golden Gate Bridge is the monument where more people have committed suicide than anywhere else in the world. For this story, I look into what's being done about it, who's affected by it, and what their stories are.
The bridge seems, at least in the Bay Area, to have some kind of magical allure. If you've seen it in the fog, it's kind of a mysterious place.
It's awesome, and when I do see it, I just go, wow.
People think it's a romantic, beautiful spot to end your life.
The Golden Gate Bridge sees 2 to 3 suicide victims a month, more than anywhere else in the world. Since the first suicide, 3 months after it opened in 1937, more than 1,600 people have jumped to their deaths from the bridge. There is no physical memorial for the dead. Instead, on a Saturday in April, family and friends gather at Mir Beach to share their familiar stories.
There isn't a minute in the day that I don't think about him and the loss.
A lot of what I do now is thinking about what he would want for me and how he would want us to live. And I know he wouldn't want us to change anything about our lives for the negative, because he just wanted us to be happy.
Michael was an extremely caring and sweet's a word I think a lot of his friends would use. Very caring person, and he had become even more so as he matured and got older. When he played the violin, he was so focused, and I never had to tell him to, Michael, you need to practice. Prior to the day, Michael seemed to be on top of the world. He seemed quite happy. The night before Michael died, we know that he was on his computer, and the last site he was on was the Golden Gate Bridge. I got a call from Tanya, his girlfriend, with whom he lived, about 10 in the morning. And she said, "Have you heard from Michael?" And I said, "No, why?" And she said, "Well, something strange. He left for work about 8:30, and he left his cell phone, and he left his wallet." About 3:00 in the afternoon, I got a call from the Marin County Sheriff's Department. They said a witness saw him jump at 9 in the morning, and that the Coast Guard picked him up at 9:35. And he said there was a note on the passenger's side of the seat. "Dear loved ones, I am sorry for any pain I am causing you. It is the last thing I would want to do. I love you all deeply, but I have found that my love for you cannot overcome the overwhelming sense that I do not belong in this world."
Ray and Mary Zablotny know this loss as well. Their son Jonathan jumped from the bridge in 2005. He was 18 and months away from graduating high school. Ray, a practicing psychiatrist for more than 30 years, started a support group for others like them. Kay is a member. Ray's and Kay's connection doesn't end there. Ray had met Kay's son Michael. He treated him as a patient in 2005, 6 years before Michael would end his life the same way his own son had.
I'm Dr. Raymond Zablotny, a psychiatrist. And
since Jonathan's death, Ray and Mary have spoken before numerous government agencies asking for a suicide barrier for the Golden Gate and other bridges. In 2008, their efforts paid off when the Golden Gate Bridge District Board approved construction of a safety net, but the project still needs $45 million. Many who argued against the net said it would be pointless and the suicidal person would find another way.
I'm convinced that Michael would be here if the bridge hadn't offered an opportunity for him to kill himself. It's so easy. You walk onto that bridge at any time of the day. That railing is 4.5 feet. Anybody could leap over that.
A study we often cite to prove the necessity of a suicide barrier is the Seiden study, looking at data about 500 people who were taken off the bridge for being suicidal, and then working very hard to follow them up to 20 years later and see if they were still alive. And 94% were still alive and had not made further suicide attempts.
If there were a barrier there the day I jumped, I would never have considered the Golden Gate Bridge. Now, would I have considered something else? Would I have still considered suicide? I believe yes, because that was my mindset, is I want to die.
Keyboards and mouse pads, guys, come on.
Asher. Now a high school teacher in Angels Camp, California, Ken Baldwin is only one of about 30 who have survived jumping from the Golden Gate Bridge.
See you tomorrow.
I just want to be gone. I just wanted to disappear. One of the things I didn't want to do is I didn't want to have anybody find me. And so, you know, hanging myself or shooting myself or something like that was out of the question. And so then I started thinking about the bridge and the percentages of jumping off the bridge and dying were very, very good. And that became my focus. And so I walked out to about half, about the midpoint of the bridge, and I stood there looking at the city. I looked around, and there was nobody around me, so I counted to 10, and I didn't do it. So I said, no, you really have to do this. You have to buck up and do this. And so I counted to 10 again, and I jumped over. Once I looked up and once my hands left the bridge, I realized, oh my God, this is the worst thing that could ever happen to not just me, but my whole family. And then I looked down and next thing I know, I'm in the water. And I was going, oh my God, please, somebody save me. Somebody save me. I want to live. I want to be through this. And the next thing I know, I was on a Coast Guard cutter. For 28 years, I've been alive when I shouldn't be.
That's good. And
eventually, the bridge is a symbol of what I live today and how I live today. And it means a lot to me.
The grief has this quality of coming in waves, and the waves are like a storm at Ocean Beach at first. There are lots of them.
Oh, that's way too big.
Over months and half years, it's like a calmer place where the waves
are further apart.
The Obama administration recently announced a scientific endeavor called the Brain Initiative, in an effort to map the complexities of the human brain. The initiative will bring together experts from across the nation to do for neuroscience what the Human Genome Project did for genetics. I wanted to find out how this research might play out in the lives of two East Bay residents with Parkinson's disease. Every day, Howard Martin takes his dog Jerry for a walk.
Okay, he's ready.
Howard, at 67, is an active retiree who goes sailing on a regular basis. Nothing out of the ordinary, just a man walking his dog on a sunny morning in Oakland, California. But eventually, his movements become erratic. Howard has Parkinson's disease, a neurodegenerative disorder he's battled for over 13 years. And when he encounters these symptoms, he can control them by using a device called a deep brain stimulator.
They turned it on and it worked instantly. The subconscious control came back and I didn't have to worry about forcing myself to smile. It just instantly came back.
A decade ago, Howard wouldn't be able to do many of the things he does today, including taking a walk for hours at a time. Yet despite technological advancements, the brain remains one of the greatest scientific mysteries. Recently, President Obama announced a $100 million investment in a brain mapping initiative.
There's this enormous mystery waiting to be unlocked. And the Brain Initiative will change that by giving scientists the tools they need to get a dynamic picture of the brain in action and better understand how we think and how we learn and how we remember.
If we understand from a basic science point of view how a particular brain region functions or how the brain functions as a whole to give rise to certain processes, then, for example, in diseases like Parkinson's disease, Alzheimer's, or neuropsychiatric diseases, mental diseases, we might have a way of intervening in a process that's gone bad if we know how the process worked to begin with.
Yes.
10 years ago, the FDA approved a procedure called deep brain stimulation, which works like a pacemaker for the brain. That's what Howard uses to control the tremors and slowed movement that disrupt his daily life. When combined with physical rehabilitation and medications, people like Howard are now able to lead more independent lives.
It's your remote that communicates through the skin to the transmitter and generator. Hear a beep? That means we're connected. I'm talking to it.
The electrode itself is a little bigger than 1 millimeter in diameter, so it's quite small. The area that we're targeting is about the size of a large lima bean. And so hitting that area blind from the surface of the head to an area that's about 8 centimeters deep in the brain is quite a challenging problem.
Not everyone is a candidate for DBS. And because there is no high-resolution map of the brain, patients must be kept awake during the surgery so that doctors can interact with them to fine-tune the placements of the probes. Some Parkinson's disease patients are wary of such an invasive procedure. Herb Hines decided not to have it.
And normally in an operation, I think you sort of get knocked out and then you wake up and, you know, there you are. But in this case, I have to be awake, and that just somehow really scares me. I mean, 15 years ago, there wasn't deep brain stimulation. 50 years ago, there wasn't even dopamine. I'd be dead, you know, already. I'm sure of it.
For Howard, those advancements didn't come soon enough to save his father, who spent the last 5 years of his life in a nursing home with advanced Parkinson's disease.
I received a letter when I was in the Navy in the Mediterranean. My mother said he'd been diagnosed with Parkinson's. When I was 6 or 7 years old, we were farming wheat and sugar beets and alfalfa in Jerome, Idaho. And the crop duster would come out, and a lot of times he'd drift sideways, so he needed a mark to aim at. My father would be at one end of the field, and I'd be at the other end of the field with flags. Could have been DDT. In fact, I'm sure it was. I was up to 28 pills a day 4 pills every 2.5 hours.
What can we do about it, given that we have Parkinson's with our resources that we have? And it turns out that there's a lot going on that's really hopeful. One thing that, the only thing that seems to be a super powerful, you know, intervention that has no side effects is exercise.
At Dance Space in Oakland, California, a unique program is helping Parkinson's disease patients manage their symptoms.
I got this experience of having this class 5 years ago or so that really changed my life. I saw these guys moving gracefully, and the way that they joined everybody in the room together, all these people with Parkinson's.
You can map the human brain, I assume, but you can't map every aspect of it any more than you can figure out the universe. On the other hand, yeah, explore it, you know, and find out what we can, because that'll enable us to do things like create dopamine pills and deep brain stimulators, which have made a huge difference to people like me and Howard.
At UC Berkeley, by using an MRI, Jack Gallant has effectively seen into the mind's eye.
The job of my lab is to try to divide the brain into appropriate parts, and then once we know what the constituent parts are, we want to understand their function in a really defined mathematical way. In this demonstration, we're showing how we can reconstruct what a person saw from their brain activity.
The top image is what the subject is seeing, and the bottom is the computer's interpretation of that image.
You can see if this is a person, then the top clip always looks like people. But if this is something really abstract, like an elephant, then the top clip doesn't look like anything good. The brain essentially uses feedback with the world to calibrate itself. So, you know, if you have a thought about something you want, you go out and you do it, you interact with the world, and those motor movements you make in the world actually help your brain regulate itself.
And that may provide a reason why dance therapy works, to improve the lives of Parkinson's disease patients. To show us the stark difference of his life without his deep brain stimulator, Howard offered to turn it off.
Yes, you'll see my tremors come back, and the muscles will start to slow down, and my voice is hard to control when it is off. But it takes over your whole body. It's like a veil of deadening of the muscles. I feel like I'm shutting down. It's real difficult to move my hand in now.
Expression in your face is gone.
I feel like I'm being swallowed up by the chair.
Yeah.
I'm ready to try the walk.
Okay.
I put it over here by the bar for a reason.
Some of these diseases that affect the brain, that affect the mind, understanding the connections of the brain is something that we're just in our infancy of understanding. The hope, of course, is that it will enable the technologies that will let us answer those bigger questions. This initiative can help get us started.
After 2 minutes, Howard sits down and turns the stimulator back on.
The big struggle's over. Well, what a relief.
It looked like you let go of all these, like you were just, you know,
right.
All these muscles opened up.
Yeah, I can smile again. Reality of it is pretty, it's down the road in the future, but we can get there. It's like Kennedy took him 10 years to get to the moon. Yeah, but somebody's got to lead the way.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.